Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president is peeved. Congress is peeved. Taxpayers are definitely peeved about those AIG bonuses. But that's yesterday's news. Today, it's all about how to get the money back. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice, in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, the 17th of March. Good to have you here. They were lining up to get to the microphones on Capitol Hill today, senators and representatives alike promising to do all they can to get the AIG bonus money back. Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she's hoping for legislation on it as soon as next week. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more now on how Congress might actually be able to turn things around.
New York's Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer had a message today for the CEO of AIG.
Mr. Liddy, I urge you to fix this mess. Because let me tell you something, we are all fed up, and if you don't fix it, we will.
Schumer and a bipartisan group of senators sent a letter to Liddy this morning saying he should tell executives that got the bonuses to return them.
Because if they don't, we plan to virtually tax all of it.
More than a dozen lawmakers are drafting bills aimed at taxing the AIG bonuses into oblivion, creating special tax rates of, say, 90 or 100%. Walker Todd is a former Federal Reserve attorney. He says investigators also need to look for accounting fraud at the company.
If it could be shown that the books were improperly prepared, then the payment of these bonuses could be fraudulent as the tainted fruit of the tainted tree.
And that seems to be where New York's Attorney General, Andrew Cuomo, is headed. Cuomo revealed today that 11 executives who received more than $1 million each for, quote, retention bonuses, received them after leaving AIG. And the bonus payments weren't based on the executives or the company's performance. Instead, Cuomo said the contracts guaranteed executives the same bonus they got in 2007, even though by the time these contracts were signed in March of 2008, it was clear AIG was headed for disaster. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank chairs the House Financial Services Committee. As it happens, AIG CEO Ed Liddy is going to be the guest of one of his subcommittees at a hearing tomorrow in Washington. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's your latest take, sir, on what ought to be done about these AIG bonuses?
I want to explore what rights we might have as the effective owner of the company. That is, it is one thing for us as a regulator to say, well, those things shouldn't have been done. It would be another for the owner, which is the federal government de facto now and should be de jure, to say, well, you know, you didn't deserve a bonus. Your work was pretty lousy. We're going to look at this and sue. Mr. Liddy will be testifying before the subcommittee, the committee I chair tomorrow. We are going to be pressing him to tell us who these people are, and it's possible that the publicity might lead some of them to feel, as I would hope they would, badly embarrassed about what they're doing.
What specifically do you want to hear from Mr. Liddy, the CEO of AIG, tomorrow?
We would like him to say that he is going to do everything possible to try to get the money back, that and that he would retract half of what he said. His argument has been, first, well, I can't get the money back because they were binding contracts, but then he also gives a policy reason, which suggests that he's not really eager to get it all back. He says these are bonuses that were necessary to retain these people. Well, I'm very skeptical that they're the people that have to be retained. In the first place, clearly a lot of mistakes were made at AIG. Secondly, it's kind of hard to argue that they couldn't replace them. We're in a market now, which is an employer's market in the financial services area. A lot of very decent people have lost their jobs, some incompetent people, but some very competent people because of the general financial situation. So the notion that they couldn't find other people to replace these people if they quit because they didn't get a retention bonus makes me very skeptical.
We've owned this company, the taxpayers have, for months now, and still this is happening. Why is this still happening?
Because people had not expected there to be this degree of irresponsibility. Look, it begins with the Federal Reserve coming to Congress in September of last year and not asking us and not consulting us, but simply announcing to us that under a statute that was passed in 1932, they had the power to make these loans. I hope they they turn out to be owned, say AIG, and they were going to do it without any conditions whatsoever. We had hoped that there would be some common sense in all this, and we have since passed legislation because they got some money from the rescue plan that would affect what they could do going forward. But this is a real disappointment that they had already done this and didn't tell anybody.
How confident are you that, given the recent turn of events, despite being assured by the Obama administration and the Bush administration that taxpayers are going to get their money back, that we're actually going to be made whole out of this?
Oh, I am not optimistic with regard to AID. I am in some other areas. I think we're already seeing signs, as they said, some of the TARP money is being paid back, and I think most of what the Federal Reserve has done is well collateralized. I think the answer is nobody knows. But to some extent, it's not operational because you want to act to do your best to maximize that return. And, you know, I hope maybe I'm more pessimistic than I could be. I'm not as optimistic as some who say we're going to get it all back.
Barney Frank, Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. Congressman, thanks for your time.
Bye.
The Federal Reserve is meeting on interest rates today and tomorrow. I sort of can't believe I'm saying this, but it would be interesting to be a fly on the wall there for a little while. Because since interest rates are already basically at zero, the Fed can't really do much else with its traditional tools that it uses for guiding the economy. But Chairman Bernanke and his colleagues have been trying some other tricks to encourage the flow of money through the financial system. Even though there is probably not going to be an interest rate announcement when the meeting wraps up tomorrow, people are going to be watching what else the Fed says to figure out what it's going to do. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
Since last fall, the Fed has been trying to prime the economy's lending pumps by buying mortgages and other consumer credit loans. The Fed is betting that when lenders get more cash, they'll offer cheaper mortgages and bring down housing costs. For a while, mortgage interest rates fell from above 6%, but Morgan Stanley's Ted Weissman says that stopped.
30-year mortgage rates for consumers have been stalled out at a little over 5%. I think the Fed and the Treasury would like to get that down towards 4.5%, and the question is, what's the best way to do that?
Weissman thinks the Fed should try a new strategy, buy Treasury bonds. The yield on Treasuries has been rising recently, which puts upward pressure on mortgage rates. By buying hundreds of billions of dollars of government bonds, the Fed could lower their cost and keep mortgage rates under control. But Gerald O'Driscoll, a former Dallas Fed vice president, says it's going to take more than lower interest rates to get money moving again.
And the Fed is doing what it can do, but it's not the problem. I think it's pretty clear now that even when you flood the banks with liquidity, that many of them are reluctant to loan, especially to each other.
O'Driscoll says banks are burdened with too many bad assets to start taking risks with new loans, and clearing up toxic assets isn't under the Fed's jurisdiction. O'Driscoll says there's a risk in buying Treasury bonds. By artificially pushing down interest rates, the Fed won't be able to see early signs of inflation once the economy turns around. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We've all learned to take what appear to be positive economic indicators with a grain of salt the past year or so, and today is no different. We learned this morning the number of new homes under construction shot up in February, 22% over the previous month. The grain of salt here is this. The report for that previous month, January is another way to say that, was a drop to a record low. So a bounce is great, as long as it's kept in perspective. What is interesting, though, about the February report is that much of the increase was because of the number of apartments being built. We asked Ashley Miltite to find out whether apartments might be leading the housing market back.
Anyone thinking of celebrating should probably put the champagne back in the fridge. Mike Larson is a real estate analyst with Rice Research. He says the construction of single-family homes increased just 1% in February. As for that jump in apartment starts,
it's not surprising to see a 20% decline one month, a 40% rise the next month, and so on, because you may have one or two buildings that have so many units that if they happen to get started in a certain month, it skews the overall numbers.
Housing starts surged in the Northeast and Midwest. Larson says both those areas had mild Februarys, maybe another reason why so many homes were started. Steve Malpezzi teaches real estate at the University of Wisconsin. He says construction of new homes is still near an all-time low, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
We don't want it to turn around too soon because prices are still soft, probably going to fall a little bit more, and we don't want to start adding to supply until we're seen prices firm up.
He says low prices means fewer sellers and less construction, which is bad for the whole economy. So, says Mike Larson, we should leave the cork in that bottle of bubbly until we see some steady improvement in starts, especially of single-family homes.
If we see a noticeable turn that lasts a couple of months in permits, if we see a couple months worth of stronger starts, then I think we have something to latch on to. But I don't think we've seen that yet.
He says completed buildings are nothing without buyers. And in the end, the housing market's recovery depends on higher demand. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
There are as many economic indicators out there as you'd care to count, of course. Housing is one. Oil is another. Crude bumped up better than $2 today, above $49 a barrel, on some unexplained notion that the worst of this whole mess is somehow behind us. Stock traders followed suit. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Many of us are learning to do more with less, or maybe even just scraping by doing the same with less. Not so, though, for our pets. From kitty condos to puppy perfume and gourmet treats, there is plenty of evidence that our creatures are still living in plenty of comfort. About $52 billion worth of comfort every single year, as a matter of fact. And now one big company in the human food business is taking notice, as Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll explains.
Tyson Foods produces chops, chicken breasts, steak. The company usually puts food on the table. Now it wants to put food under the table. Tyson said today it's joining forces with Freshpet to market the first national brand of refrigerated dog food. The products will be sold in supermarkets. Freshpet founder Scott Morris says it's food for dogs, not dog food.
Well, the difference here is that they all start with meat, fresh meats. They blend in vegetables, brown rice, and then they're gently processed, which is part of the magic here.
The real magic will be getting consumers to spend 10 or 15% extra for Freshpet's doggy meatballs and bologna, especially when they're trading down on their own groceries. Lisa Harper runs specialty store Paparazzi in Oregon. She says even in the downturn, customers are still willing to pay up for pricey chow.
They're not willing to give up on the food quality level, but they are willing to give up on some of the other things.
That could be good news for Tyson. It's been hurt by slowing demand for its people food. The pet food industry brings in about $20 billion a year, and it's growing. Lifestyle guru Martha Stewart has taken notice, too. She's launching an online pet channel and has a line of pet products in the works. Pet industry expert Michael Dillon says Americans are in the full throes of puppy and pet love.
I think it's partially due to the changing demographics of America. People are having fewer children later in life, and they are highly emotionally attached to pets.
So yeah, the economy's going to the dogs. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. Here is your Irish news of the day. Pittsburgh Steelers owner Dan Rooney can add another line to his resume right above winning this year's Super Bowl. President Obama named Rooney the new American ambassador to Ireland this morning. The announcement was part of a traditional St. Paddy's Day visit to the White House by the Irish Prime Minister. Back in Ireland, though, there is less to be celebrating. The Irish economy, once known as the Celtic Tiger, is distinctly whimpering, and young people are scrambling to figure out how to survive. Youth Radio's Pendarvis Harshaw reports.
So how are you, Ruth?
Rosie Ward is 26 years old and has big dreams. But for now, she's stuck working in a tiny coffee shop in the town of Ardee, about an hour outside of Dublin. The shop used to sell pastries to busloads of tourists and a steady stream of construction workers. This year, business mostly comes from local customers.
It's okay. It's a bit slow at the minute, but hopefully things will pick up.
Ward eventually wants to find work as a bookkeeper, settle down with her boyfriend, and start a family. But she's finding it a little difficult to plant seeds on Ireland's unstable economic terrain. Ward's boyfriend is a plasterer, but construction projects are drying up.
He hasn't had work since the end of November, so he's heading off to Germany now next week for about 3 months, working on a project over there.
Ward says this uncertainty, this need to travel overseas for work, is a new experience for many of her friends who grew up during Ireland's boom years. For most of their lives, foreign investment rolled into the Emerald Isle, creating jobs and expanding credit. McCormick Lynch is a former investment banker who left Ireland in the 1980s when career prospects were limited. When Lynch returned two decades later, he saw many Irish people living beyond their means.
The government decided that all this extra wealth that was coming into Ireland, that they would basically just have low taxes and let the Irish population have that money themselves. So what you then had was rampant house price inflation and very little investment in services. What has happened now is that Irish people have suddenly come to the point where they realize that we can't borrow any more money.
With the Irish economy in a rut, Lynch says there's only one piece of advice he'd give recent college graduates.
If it was me, I'd leave Ireland. I'd be out of here for a couple of years, tour the world, because I think it's going to be very depressing.
In Dublin, there are plenty of young professionals having a hard time finding good employment. 27-year-old lawyer Kira Shaughnessy says salaries at her firm have been cut by 30%. She says she knows plenty of young lawyers who plan to leave the country.
People are being forced to go abroad, and people are very well educated, so they're not going to be willing to stay here and get handouts from the government.
Today, Ireland's unemployment rate is at 10%, the same level as before the boom. Back in Ardee, waitress Rosie Ward is saving her money for a summer trip to Australia, where she'd also be looking for work until the Irish economy recovers.
Luckily, my job is safe at the minute, but who's to say this time next year we're still going to be here?
That's not something this generation thought they'd be asking themselves after growing up during one of the most prosperous times Ireland has ever seen. For now, their lofty dreams have been put on hold. In Ardee, Ireland, I'm Pendarvis Harshaw for Marketplace.
That story was produced for us by Youth Radio, along with Ireland's Ardmore Sound. Coming up, online dating in a down economy.
So the recession is actually good for the industry.
Yeah, it's unfortunate it's good for the internet dating industry, really. It's not like we're clapping our hands and parting it up.
But first, let's do the numbers. Traders found a four-leaf clover today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average got a 178-point boost, nearly 2.5%, closed at 73.95. The Nasdaq found the pot of gold, jumping 58 points, more than 4%, ended the day at 1462. The S&P 500 rose 24 points. That's close to 3.25%, finished at 778. Colgate-Palmolive, the maker of Irish Spring Soap, of course, closed nearly 3% higher. Shares of General Mills were magically delicious. They rose nearly 0.5%. Then there's Diageo, the maker of everybody's favorite Irish beer, Guinness. That stock ended the day nearly 0.4% higher. The housing data was good news for Home Depot. Shares rose by more than 6.5%. Bonds fell today. The yield on 10-year T-notes rose to 3.01%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis. Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for February. A House Subcommittee on Aviation holds a hearing on air traffic control modernization. And President Obama arrives in California. His two-day schedule includes town hall meetings and an appearance on The Tonight Show. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. As if we didn't have enough to worry about already, today the World Bank said the recession here and abroad is threatening water projects around the world. And it says industrialized countries like the United States haven't set aside enough stimulus package money to replace our aging water infrastructure.
According to the United Nations, that could cost upwards of $200 billion a year, none of which is lost on towns and cities in this country where drinking water is getting more and more expensive. And some say the private sector is helping to push those prices up. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Elaine Grant reports.
Lock Lake Colony is a rural development of 900 homes in central New Hampshire. It's beautiful, but under the surface, the community has a lot of problems. The water system is decades old. Some days, says resident Mike Rinaldi, you'd turn on the tap and nothing would come out. So a private water company bought Lock Lake system and invested $2.5 million fixing it.
We now have water. They're still working on some of the pipes because some of the pipes are dated back to the 1960s.
But now the company wants to triple Lock Lake's water rates. That could mean paying an extra $1,000 a year. And Rinaldi says his neighbors can't afford it.
They're going to be hit hard. They really, really are. We had two people that were on fixed incomes that, when they found out about this, tried to put their houses up on the market, but they just can't sell it.
More and more people are struggling to pay high water bills. Today, 14% of Americans get their water from for-profit companies, and many are hiking their rates. Private utilities argue they're investing in projects like new wells and pipes. Critics say these businesses are just trying to maximize profits. Most states set a cap on how much profit these utilities can make, typically 10%, and it's rare for companies to make less than that. John Kiesecker is a researcher with Food and Water Watch.
In California, Illinois, Wisconsin, and New York, households receiving water from a private water company paid on average 13 to 50% more than households receiving water from a public water utility.
Industry lobbyists say their prices may look higher, but that's because when a city provides water, some of the cost is paid for with local taxes. But when a commercial water company fixes a system, customers bear the full expense. And that's hard on small communities.
Small system problems, the Achilles heel of the water business in the United States.
That's Peter Cook, executive director of the National Association of Water Companies. He argues that private utilities are more efficient, especially in larger towns and cities. But most of the systems that private companies run are small rural ones.
Many of them, if not most of them, all are troubled because of the small economies of scale and the fact that their populations probably aren't big wage earners and have limited funds.
No matter the price, John Kiesecker of Food and Water Watch argues that selling water for profit is a bad idea.
I think when folks see water being privatized, they see a price being put on something that's essential.
And it's becoming more and more essential to fix this country's aging and leaky plumbing. The federal stimulus package includes more than $8 billion for drinking and wastewater treatment projects. That money should begin to flow soon. Then the big question will it help ease the pain at the tap? From Barnstead, New Hampshire, I'm Elaine Grant for Marketplace.
Dating can be awkward. It can be painful. It can be, in its worst incarnations, humiliating. But it is almost always going to cost you money. New outfits, dinner and drinks, a movie or a show. With people cutting back, you'd think the dating industry would be hurting, but it's not. Because it turns out that when the Dow drops, singles search even harder for mates. Sally Herships went on the prowl to find out why a bad economy can mean good news for the business of love.
Can you put a price on love? Janice Spindell can. She's a matchmaker in Manhattan, and she is not cheap.
My basic fees to retain me, to even just get me to talk to you or work for you, is $25,000 upfront.
And depending on the client, her rates can zip right up to $250,000. But even in the midst of recession, Spindell says she is busy.
Busier than I could possibly deal with.
Her calendar is booked 3 weeks in advance. But it's not just millionaires matchmakers who are busy right now. Match.com, the online dating service, had over 20% more members this December than last. And digital Cupid eHarmony did a study that shows when the stock market dips, traffic to their site increases. Mark Brooks is a consultant to the online dating industry.
Now we have a recession. We're seeing double-digit growth in many of the leading companies.
I asked him if the numbers would be even higher if the economy was doing well.
I think they'd be flat. I don't think it would be growing at the same sort of level right now.
So the recession is actually good for the industry.
Yeah, it's unfortunate it's good for the internet dating industry, really. It's not like we're clapping our hands and parting it up.
Maybe they should. How is it this one particular industry is doing so well? Why aren't people cutting back?
When people are going through tough times, they look to be with people who care about them, who will understand their concerns.
That's psychologist Dr. Michael Cunningham. He's been studying relationships for decades. One of the important things, he says, people get when they connect is support, which can feel awfully good if you're doing something that challenges your confidence, like job hunting.
Looking for a job is an unequal status relationship. They have the money, the position that you want. You're begging.
But when you go out on a date,
there are two people who may have exactly the same status and exactly the same needs and exactly the same interest.
Meet in the middle, and you can cheer each other up. And that's why Boston resident Rachel Levy continues to spend money on socializing. The 37-year-old was laid off in July. She's looking for a new job in marketing and a boyfriend. One of her friends suggested a two-for-one.
And I said, what do you mean by that? She said, well, if you meet somebody who's going to offer you a job and a date, would you take it? And I said, absolutely. That's more bang for my buck. So,
how much does each date end up costing you?
Oh, probably 100, I would guess.
Wow. Levy just spent $700 on a matchmaking service called Lunch Dates, which doesn't include lunch, by the way. She says she knows all this dating is expensive, but she doesn't consider it to be discretionary. After all, she wants to have a family and kids, regardless of the economy. And that's an attitude the dating industry, well, loves. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a twist on help wanted ads as recession-induced unemployment keeps ticking up. If you're out of work and looking, check out a website called jobafiles.com. That's J-O-B-A-P-H-I-L-E-S. A bunch of unemployed college graduates in Boston set it up. You sign up and bid on jobs by how little you'd be willing to work for. We came across it at Wired Magazine's website, the latest entry in what's being called the gig economy. Workers going from short-term job to short-term job to another short-term job. Our job here is done for today. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 178 points, nearly 2.5%, closed at 73.95. NASDAQ jumped 58 points, more than 4%, ended the day at 1462. The S&P 500 rose 24 points, more than 3%, finished up at 778. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our morning report crew. Coming up next time on this program, the folks that brought you mortgage-backed securities are sure they will ride again.
There will come a time, there will come a day, when our industry will once again deliver the type of financial efficiencies on which modern society depends.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.